Welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and this is episode number 61 of the Learning Digital Photography podcast. With me on the show this week, believe it or not, is one of the Photoshop guys. I'm so excited to welcome to the show Mr. Dave Cross. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's very happy to have you on the show. This is quite an honor and a privilege. And the reason why this actually came about, we started communicating with each other about education and shooting for different purposes. My last show, I talked about shooting for lighting or shooting for composition. And then Dave approached me and asked if I would be interested in having a show on shooting for Photoshop.
Right.
I thought that would be an awesome topic, and I said I'm more than happy to. So, Dave, welcome to the show, and let's just get things started real quick. What did you mean when you were talking about shooting for or shooting with Photoshop in mind, I guess I should say?
Well, you know, really what it came down to was a number of years ago at Photoshop World, I was sitting in the instructor lounge with some of the other instructors who coincidentally were all photographers, most of whom don't even use Photoshop, which was, you know, kind of what happens at Photoshop World sometimes. And they were having a discussion of the role of Photoshop and where kind of those, the mindset was get it right in the camera, only use Photoshop if you absolutely need to, almost suggesting it was like cheating to use Photoshop. And I was kind of thinking, well, you know, I agree with that. When I take photos, I want to get it right in the camera as much as I can. But I just had this feeling that if you're only looking at Photoshop as something to fix problems, you're missing an opportunity. So I said, you know, sometimes I take photos with Photoshop in mind, like I'm already planning ahead that I'll put this tree on this layer and I'll put a different sky there and kind of make a composite image that creates something that I really like the look of. So I'm almost pre-visualizing Photoshop as I'm looking through the viewfinder. So I'm thinking, you know, if I frame this so that there's space on the right-hand side, it'll be a lot easier for me to put in a second photograph than if I decide that after the fact and have to artificially, you know, add room or something like that.
So I like what you were just saying when you were talking about compositing inside of Photoshop, where you take multiple images and stacking them, especially with pre-visualization, like you mentioned, with, you know, leaving a little space to add something else in over here. I guess what that comes down to for me, and I'm sure probably for a lot of listeners, is what if I don't have the Photoshop skills to do these kinds of advanced compositing things where you need to do things like layer masks and, right, and overlays and painting white with black or painting black with white. I'm probably getting a little too technical for my audience there, but do you incorporate that into your visualization process, well, saying, okay, take a picture of this and I mean, layer mask that out?
It could be as simple as say you're working with a senior, so you want to do a senior photograph of your family friend that's, you know, in their senior of high school, and you're thinking, I just want to do something a little different than have just a standard portrait. So in the first photo, you have them lean up against the brick wall, but you leave all the space on the side, and then the second photo, you just take a nice headshot, and even if you don't do any masking, it's just still, now you've created a space so that when you take the headshot, you put a nice border around it, and just like that, you've got a nice layout that could be printed in something a little different than the typical photo that they might get. Now, obviously, you can, if you want to, you can take to the next level and actually extract them and blend them in and all that kind of stuff, but it could be just as simple as take five photographs in a row of a sequence of events and then use Photoshop to make a film strip so you're creating like a storyboard instead of separate images.
Sure. And I guess kind of tied into that, because I see a lot of people talking about things like green screens these days, where they're taking pictures of people in front of a green screen. And for those of you that don't know, a green screen is this neutral, obvious background that is very easily selected and removed to insert something else, whether it be a brick wall or a mountain scene or, you know, a graduating class or an auditorium or, you know, whatever you want to do there. Would you incorporate things like green screens into that environment? So, like you said, if you're going to do a senior portrait, would you bring someone into a studio environment, shoot them in front of a green screen, and say, okay, here's the backgrounds that I've taken pictures of. What background do you want?
Well, that's certainly an option. Now, part of this, too, is I have to be honest and say I'm also extremely lazy. So, you know, if I can, like in my new studio, I have a fake brick wall and a fake graffiti. It's actually, well, it's not fake. It's an actual roll-down door, but I had graffiti sprayed on it, so it looks sure. like it's an outdoor spot. So in a case like that, frankly, it's a lot easier to position someone in front of that wall and just take a photograph of it. But sure. if the circumstance is such that, say, I'm working with and there's, you know, 30 kids who are in their karate school and they all want some really cool poster, it right. would be a lot easier to have them on a green screen so that if I need to extract multiple people, I can do that more easily. Sure. So, you know, that certainly can help. But part of it is the whole concept of saying giving yourself more options, really. So the nice thing about green screen, as you said, is it can be easier to extract someone. So someone who doesn't quite know how to do it on a busier background, if you've got a nice plain green background, it can be easier. In fact, I kind of came up with a way to semi-automate it so that it can be done fairly automatically and do a whole series of images fairly quickly.
Ooh, I'm interested in learning how to do that if it's an automated thing. That's very cool. And that kind of ties into an original – I shouldn't say an original, but a prior discussion that I'm sure many people have had about this whole question of whether or not it's okay to edit. You know, we've had things going on in the news. You know, I remember – I think it was even last year where someone photoshopped an image or edited an image and made it look like there was a third missile coming out of – Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever the heck it was. And it brings about this whole question of legitimacy and whether or not it's legitimate or okay to edit. And I've heard dual sides of this equation. The first side says, well, it's not okay to edit because that's not really what the camera captured. And then the flip side is, but that's only really applicable in photojournalism types of scenarios where you're reporting news or current events or topical events. And then that perspective says, if it's not photojournalism, I think it – who was it? It was I think it was Frederick Van Johnson from This Week in Photography that said pixels were born to be punished. Meaning I'm free to edit. You know, as long as it's not journalism, you're free to edit as much or as little as you want. And I guess you would subscribe to that theory for this approach to photography then, correct?
Yeah, and I mean if I was given an assignment to say go and document this event – that's photojournalism and that's capture it as best I can in the situation. But for me, it's always been about art. So my philosophy is when I look at a photograph, one of the things, the way I kind of judge its value to me is would I put this on my wall? I'm not going to look at it and say, I seriously doubt that's one shot or I seriously doubt that's HDR. I don't care. Is it attractive? Is it eye-catching? Is it beautiful? So however you get there, to me, I don't really care. You know, some people are the purists that say, well, if you don't get it right in the camera, and that's why I think there's all this debate about HDR, because some people say HDR isn't real. And it's like, well, you know, it's another art form. I personally have my own taste about what I do and don't like with HDR, but I look at it as two things. What do I like and what's attractive? And if I'm in the business of selling a photograph, for example, doing a senior portrait, I know I have a much better shot if I create something really cool that the student is going to love because it's not just your typical photograph. It's a composite of several, or it's got a really crazy graffiti border or something that's not just the photograph itself. That's those days are gone. You know, the fact the cookie cutter, here's your grad photo thing doesn't cut it anymore, especially if you're in business. I have a print in my studio that's, you know, a giant canvas that I got of this kind of composite of this kid and standing and a profile with his name looking like it's on the brick wall. And every single person that comes in goes, hey, that's really cool.
Right.
It's not just, oh, there's a nice photo of a person. It's different. It's unusual. And it catches people's eye. So if that's cheating, so be it.
Well, and I see it's interesting you said that, you know, that the days of yore are gone where, you know, it used to be just a standard portrait on a muslin background. And, you know, I think Owen Mills is the one that made that famous way back in the day. And I can't tell you the number of people that I've spoken to that say, okay, here's what I don't want.
Yeah,
and then they show me the Owen Mills shots from like circa 1970s and 1980s.
Exactly.
And I'm probably dating myself there. But anyway.
And here's the other thing, Jason, that always intrigues me when I do get in these discussions with the so-called purist, you know, get it right in the camera.
Purist,
And they're the ones that, for example, they don't hesitate to use Nick Silver Effects Pro to make a nice black and white.
Exactly.
So, okay, how is that all that different? Or take it back even further, the whole argument of, well, Ansel Adams used to spend hours in the darkroom tweaking his photographs. So
dodging and burning, that's right.
Did it differently than we do it today. Nice. So to me,
it's just like you said, it's not really how you get there as long as you get there.
Right.
I think that's the critical.
And I mean, I've been teaching Photoshop forever, and often people will say, you know, I'm probably doing this the wrong way. And I interrupt them and say, but did you get the end result you wanted? And they're like, well, I did. It's like, well, then you're doing it the right way. I could show you a quicker way maybe, or an easier way. But the bottom line is, if you're happy with the end result,
there's no wrong
the bottom
way.
Line. You know, if you print something and your family members go, oh, that's great, I love that, then that's the most important thing.
As long as the client is happy, right? Mm-hmm. That's ultimately, from a business perspective anyway, that's ultimately what matters. If you're producing results that the client is happy with.
And even if you're not in business, the client is yourself. So if
sure, right. Yeah, from a fine art perspective, as long as you're satisfying the needs there.
Now,
well, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that whole approach of fine art photography versus client-based photography, because that's kind of what your new website speaks to, is clients that okay, why don't I just turn it over to you? Let you explain a little bit about the new website and this, I shouldn't say diversion, but this new track that you're adding on for people who are interested in these smaller workshops,
right.
These, what is it, 20-person workshops?
Yeah, it's sometimes even less. Basically what it is way back when I was living in Canada, I had my own training center and I was teaching Photoshop classes. But in retrospect, I think I was a little perhaps ahead of my time, because I was teaching Photoshop back when it was like Photoshop 2, and it was mostly used by print shops and sign makers and ad agencies, and the internet was so new that nobody really used it. So I would run classes and have a few people there, and it was fine. But after years of traveling the countryside doing big seminars with large groups of people, which I still continue to do, by the way, I realized that one of the things that I was kind of missing was I really liked the additional aspect of having the small class, where it's like anywhere from 6 to 15 to 18 people for a day or two in a small group, where there's a much more intense learning situation, and ones that can combine shooting and Photoshop. So, for example, Joel Grimes is coming in from California, and he's doing a workshop where the students will see how he lights and shoots in the studio, take the photos themselves, and then spend part of the day learning his Photoshop techniques of how he finishes the products and how he does HDR on the background and things like that. So it's kind of the kind of thing you wouldn't get in a seminar only, because in a seminar it's watch. In these sessions are hands-on workshops.
Yeah, it's, instead of watch, it's more learn.
Right, it's do it yourself. And most people know that you can pick up a lot. I mean, I really enjoy teaching the one-day seminars, and I still do that for Kelby Training Live. And but we'll have sometimes, you know, 500, 600, 700 people in the room, and everyone learns differently. So a lot of people walk away going, well, that was quite useful. But unless they get their hands on it and do it themselves fairly quickly,
right,
feel like they might lose part of it. So this way, these are workshops that are pretty intense, all levels. So including, I even have one that's called Welcome to Photoshop for people having launched the program.
Oh, nice.
And just take you through step by step, learn how to do the essential kind of operations. One of the things that's very cool about it is that in quite a few cases, the folks who are teaching there, because it's not just me, of course, I've invited some of my good friends. And, for example, Scott Kelby is teaching there in one of the very, very rare instances where he's not speaking to a group of 800 people.
He's in demand. So,
he doesn't teach very many small group classes anymore. And so he was happy to do one for me because he doesn't have to travel. I mean,
He's right there in Tampa.
My studio is right beside his, which is right now next to our home. So
It works out well.
Drive home and have dinner with his wife. So he's very excited to be doing a class, which is, again, lighting and shooting and retouching, but in a nice hands-on environment of like 18 people or less.
Right. So let me segue these two things together then, because we started out this conversation talking about shooting with Photoshop in mind, and then we brought in this aspect of these classes where people are going into, like you said, a pretty intense type of training environment where it's not just a seminar, like an informational session where they're actually learning how to do things in Photoshop, learning how to do compositing, and possibly even learning how to take better pictures. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at the Joel Grams workshop, you know, there's a lot of probably compositional approaches and techniques that he'll be able to offer the students that they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to. So then the question naturally becomes, if someone is interested in learning more about photography, interested in learning more about Photoshop and taking pictures with Photoshop in mind, if someone doesn't have a lot of experience in Photoshop to realize the benefits of layer masking, compositing and editing and mask selections and all these advanced editing techniques that are available, especially with layering, I think that's probably the most powerful feature of it. So the point being, if people don't have a lot of Photoshop experience, like say, for example, someone's into photography and all they've used is Lightroom.
Right.
And, you know, they have their perfect layers just came out recently, too, from On One. But if they're used to Lightroom, I think the question naturally becomes, how do I shoot with Photoshop in mind if I don't know what Photoshop can do?
Right. And that's a really good point, because part of what a lot of the sessions do, almost every session, I can't imagine a Photoshop session we're going to teach that doesn't include layers, because, as you said, that's such a key element. So part of the idea, like I actually, this whole shoot with Photoshop in mind, I actually coined my own term to describe it called Photoshop photography, which is my term for the whole Photoshop and photography together. So, for example, in the one-day workshop on that topic, it will start off showing, here's examples of what you can do in Photoshop, so now let's do some shooting to use that example to show how to put it together.
And I think that's where it's actually going to be most helpful for people that are trying to get a grasp on not only learning how to take better pictures, but also learning how to delve into Photoshop by having these kinds of hands-on workshops. And I think workshop is probably a better word for it than a seminar, because – like you said, seminar is more informational and workshop is more hands-on. And
generally, most people, at least, seminar implies large group setting with instructor with projector.
Right.
Workshop usually means hands-on, smaller group, and that's kind of the approach we're taking. Now, some of them are straight classes. It's just like a Photoshop class where it's learn Photoshop for a day or two. But even then, like, for example, when RC is doing an HDR class, part of that, of course, will be going outside and taking photographs with him, giving coaching as to, since we're going to end up in HDR, here's how you need to set up your shot. So again, it's not like how to fix it later. It's, this is how you need to take the shot to be most successful putting it together as an HDR image. And that's quite typical, the kind of thing that will happen in the workshops.
And I think that kind of thing is actually very helpful for people that are interested in learning more about HDR and interested in learning more about compositing, is getting that kind of, like, in the field, so to speak, assistance and tutoring and, and I guess, guidance, for lack of a better phrase, on, like you said, how to shoot for HDR. This whole idea of shooting with Photoshop in mind, I think in and of itself is probably its own educational path, where you would have to realize, okay, well, first I need to know about the basics of composition, rule of thirds, composition, all that fun stuff, Sunny 16, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But then I also have to learn some of the nuts and bolts of Photoshop. So how do I go out on a shoot with Photoshop in mind? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, initially, if you don't know a lot about Photoshop, it helps to have a little guidance. Maybe I know for myself, when I go on a lot of the, like, for example, the Scott Kelby photo walks, which made photo walking so famous, what I've always done is gone out shooting with other people, and I try to find people that I think are better than me. You know, because the age old phrase, if you're dumb, surround yourself with smart people.
Right.
You know, so I always try and surround myself with better photographers so I can learn from them. And if I know someone is really good at HDR, I'll say, hey, let's go out, shoot the bridge this weekend. And then they can give me guidance on how to compose a scene for HDR, what the important aspects are. I know, for example, like a key one when you're shooting HDR, you have to be on a tripod. Almost invariably, you have to be on a tripod. Ideally, you have a shutter release mechanism so you're not touching the camera. You know, those are some of the very fundamental basics. But even beyond that, there's additional elements to take into consideration. If it's windy out, you know, what do you do for those kinds of scenarios?
Right.
And I think that's kind of key as to what you're getting at here with regard to shooting with Photoshop in mind. And it segues nicely into this new offering that you have of these intensive workshops that are happening. Now, are these, you said some of these are one-day classes?
Yeah, some are intended to be, for example, I call them boot camps, even though boot camps normally implies longer, just because of the suggestion that it's a one-topic intense. So, for example, a layers boot camp means spend one whole day where all we'll talk about is layers and nothing else. Now, that's a lot of information. Smart objects would be another example where I feel pretty strongly it's a very powerful tool, and to spend a whole day really seeing all the possibilities, again, hands-on, so you try it. So it's not just someone like me saying, hey, this is good, you should do it. It's like, let's work through a couple of kind of real-world scenarios of why this would be useful and compare not using smart objects with using smart objects. So classes like that are one-day intense, and then there are other workshops like Joel's that are 2 days because of the amount of topics he wants to cover. And at this point, it's still early days, so I'm right now talking about the possibly doing half-day classes and even evenings for the kind of more local Tampa audience who want to, you know, focus on one topic just for a few hours.
Sure. And I guess that kind of begets the next question, because it seems like this is such a fantastic idea as far as getting these intensive workshops together where you're teaching people to take better pictures, to take pictures with Photoshop in mind, and to be better with Photoshop. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's kind of a twofold question. The first question, I'll ask the second question first and the first question second. The second question is, do you have any plans or anticipations of taking this to a wider audience in the Tampa area? Like, I know tons of people, myself included, in Denver, that would love to participate in activities like this. I know there's probably kind of a loaded question, so I apologize for that. Because there's always the hypothetical, would it be great if...
The easy answer is who knows. But at this point, the kind of business model I have is...
Local to Tampa.
The location stays in Tampa. There's nothing I'd love better than people in Denver during the wintry cold months to go, you know, Florida is kind of nice at this time of year. Maybe I should travel there for a couple of days for a workshop. So I'm kind of in the ideal scenario. I want to be like the next Santa Fe workshop kind of destination place where people think, oh, I'm going to go there to teach, you know, or to learn. So obviously you wouldn't do that if it was just a Thursday evening, session.
Sure. Well, I think it's kind of a different...
For example, the Joel Grimes workshop, more than two-thirds of the people coming to the class are coming from outside of Tampa because they know Joel is normally in California and only teaches workshop there, so a chance to see it on the East Coast, I'm drawing from Texas and Georgia and places that are on the eastern side of the country because they know it's a better alternative than them going to California. Probably a little less expensive too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think you kind of hit on a key aspect there also when you said about Joel Grimes coming into the Tampa area. It's in that it's slightly different from, say, the Santa Fe workshops, where people go to the Santa Fe workshops because of the location.
Right.
Now, granted, there's instructors there and people there that you want to learn from, but it's not teaching the same kinds of things.
Right.
You know, that's more teaching – here's how to take pictures in this area.
Right. And the other part of it, I taught at the Santa Fe workshops, and it's a wonderful facility. But to me, it's the only possible downside for some people, at least. It's a pretty big commitment. Like, you're there for more than a full week.
Yeah.
And that's for a lot of people. That's tough to say, I'm going to take a week or 8 days out of my busy schedule. And especially since a lot of them are doing it as a hobby, so they have to take time off work. So my idea was to do it a little more intense, so it's 2, possibly 3 days. At this point, I don't see us doing like 5-day workshops unless the feedback is, I really want a 5-day workshop. But my feeling, I mean, I've taught 7-day classes before, and usually by about day 4, people's eyes start to glaze over and it's information overload. As much as interesting as it might be, after a while, there's only so much you can jam into people's brains. So that's why I thought, let's do weekends, let's do Friday, Saturdays, so people even from out of town can come into Tampa for a couple of days, bring their family. Florida is a nice place to visit. The other side of Florida Tampa has lots of other attractions well beyond, of course, just my shop. So people will be planning to bring their family and send the family to Busch Gardens while they take their workshop. And
It sounds like you should be working for the state of Florida in their tourism department. You know, while you come to our class, send your family off to Busch Gardens or Epcot Center or Disney World, or go down to the Keys and see Jimmy Buffett or
right
whoever
now,
you want. So.
In Florida, I got to be honest, it's stinking hot. But
I think it's hot all over right now.
In Florida, we put up with July and August because of December through March.
Yes.
Because December through March in Florida is absolutely paradise. It really is. It's gorgeous, not humid. So that's the time to plan ahead and come to a workshop in Florida.
There you go. There you
amazing,
go.
Especially for people in the wintry north. That's the time. I'm hoping that registrations will jump up from the northern folks.
Oh, sure. That makes sense to have that kind of a schedule in mind. The same held true in South Carolina, too. When I lived in South Carolina, some of the best times to go shooting at the beach were actually in those winter months because you had a lot more activity,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of the wind coming through the ocean that you didn't get in the summer
right.
because everything is so muffled down because of the heat. And plus, it's much more comfortable, like you said. And
yep.
there's fewer people to get in the way, so because everyone goes for the heat. And I'm like, why are you going for the heat? It's cooler in November.
Right.
So it's pretty, it's a lot of good, useful information. And where can people find the workshops at? This is at your own separate website, correct?
Yeah, it's davecrossworkshops.com is the workshop website, and that's where they can see all the currently scheduled classes. Right now I have classes scheduled up to the end of August, and I'm just working on a schedule for September and beyond, and I've already got some very cool people who have agreed to come and teach, again, including people who don't often teach small group classes. So
right.
it's going to be some
That's
interesting
awesome.
Opportunities.
And I tell you, I was mentioning this to a couple other people. I think it was in the NAP forums the other day when I saw the announcement about it. And one of the comments that I had made with regard to seminars versus workshops is that normally with teaching environments, especially in the university setting, because that's the setting that I'm used to teaching in or being a student in, or being in for that matter, I'll just leave it at that, is the student-to-teacher ratio.
Mm-hmm.
The student-to-teacher ratio in university environments peaks at about 25 to 1. You really don't want to have more than 25 students in a class to really give high quality, you know, to deliver superior quality instruction where you can get the hands-on, you can get individual questions answered, and you can get one-on-one time. So for people that may learn in different ways, the smaller group setting like you're talking about here is what is most ideal
mm-hmm.
when it comes to – and that's not just photography or Photoshop right. or anything like that. That's pick a subject. You know, it's any subject where that logic applies, where if, like you said, if you're in a room full of 500 people – and I was at the Kelby seminar for Lightroom 2.
Mm-hmm.
One or two, I forget which one it was, one of the Lightroom seminars, and good Lord, that was a lot of people.
Yeah. Now,
you know, it is very informational, and
right.
it was exciting to see Scott Kelby, you know, and I was right there front and center and just, you know, jaw dropped the whole time looking at all these new features in Lightroom 2 or whatever it was, and
yep.
I was like, I got to get this software. And so it's a unique environment, but the advantages to these smaller environments is so much more of these things that I just mentioned, you know,
right.
where there's more hands-on and all that. So this is definitely something that I think you've hit on something key that I think has been lacking in the industry.
Well, I think there's two important points. One of them is that I'm going to continue to teach large group seminars because there is a value in that, especially for people
absolutely.
Who can't travel. I can
sure.
go to a city like Denver or wherever it is and reach that many people at the same time. And because of the way Kelby Training Live is set up, it's very well done with workbooks, so you don't have to worry about mm-hmm. taking notes and all that kind of thing. So that's kind of point number one, is there's still a value to that, and I'm going to still continue to do that as much as I can.
Oh, absolutely.
But the other thing that I think is interesting to note about the small group thing, and this actually came as a result of a comment I got from the very first workshop I did earlier this month. And I only had two people in it because it was sort of my first one. So I just said, you know what, I'm just going to run it anyway just to kind of do one and make
work
sure
out the kinks.
Yeah, work out the kinks. So I did that. And one of the two participants sent me a little note to thank me for the workshop. And I don't have her exact quote in front of me, but she basically said something to the effect of, as valuable as the class itself was, it was equally or more valuable the information I got just as we chatted during breaks and at lunch. And that's another side of it that it never occurred to me. But
right.
when you get a bunch of photographers in a classroom, mm-hmm. during the breaks, they're probably not going to talk about sports unless it's photography. You know, they're not going to talk about what lens do you like in this situation. I mean, just idle chit chat is going to be another very added value of this, because the ideas you can get just from each other of sharing stories and asking questions. And, you know, I've been in the industry a long time, as have almost all the other instructors. So just a simple question during a casual conversation in some cases can be just as valuable as what you get during the formal part of the training as well.
That's right. And I didn't mean to – that you hit upon a very key point there, and I do want to at least take a moment to say, yes, I do agree with you that there's value on both sides of the aisle, whether you're talking about small group workshops or large seminar settings. If you've never seen an application before, a seminar is definitely the place to go to get as much information as you can. It's very informational, very educational in its own right. So I didn't mean to, I guess, insinuate, for lack of a better phrase,
I was saying you were. It's just I think it's important for people to realize that there's – pros to both.
Yes.
But one of the things that I've always said about seminars, and I continue to say this whenever I teach one, is that while it's great for you to sit here all day and kind of absorb information, it's going to be a lot more valuable if you run home or to your computer and try some of these things fairly quickly.
Right.
Because if you don't, then you lose a lot of that very quickly over time. And of course, that is the advantage of the hands-on, is that you watch it and then you do it right away.
Right, right. Well, listen, I'm going to wrap things up for the show here because I know you're pressed for time and I'm a little pressed for time as well. But we did have a couple questions that came in. I announced it rather quickly on Twitter where I said, you're not going to believe who I'm talking to tonight for the podcast. But a couple questions did come in via direct message and publicly. One came from a workshop that's going on in Toronto where Scott is going up for a seminar there.
Yep.
And Jason Kate's asking, is Dave coming with Scott to Toronto? I need a front row seat for that. So I guess that's question number one. Are you going to Toronto?
No, unfortunately,
with Scott?
I'm not. And that's one of our favorite stories that we all tell each other, that Scott says whenever he travels somewhere, invariably someone says, where's Matt and Dave? And I get the same thing where I'm somewhere and it's like, Scott's not with you? And like, no, we actually unfortunately don't travel together unless it's Photoshop World. That's about the only time that we actually are all traveling to the same place. I wish I could, but I'm actually going to Toronto to do a seminar myself, but it's in, I want to say, November.
Okay. So I guess look for
a – the Canadian there during the winter season because they know I can handle it.
You're the only one that can handle it are you from Toronto or Vancouver?
I was from Ottawa, actually.
Ottawa, okay. I don't know why I thought Vancouver. So. All right, well, the second question that came in was with regard to this whole subject of Photoshopography and speaking to the subject of HDR, which we hit on briefly about composing with HDR in mind. Mm-hmm. There's thoughts all across the spectrum when it comes to HDR, and I think the upshot of this problem, I'm going to let them remain happily anonymous for the purposes of the podcast, but their question was, where do you fall on the HDR spectrum? And I'm thinking they mean more towards the Harry Potter-ish or the realistic HDR. Like, what's your own personal take on
– I got to be honest, and for me, HDR, from the moment I learned what it was about, I saw HDR as a solution to a problem, not an art form. In other words, if I was faced with shooting an interior of a house and there was light streaming in the window and I thought there's no way I can capture this in one exposure, then to me that's where HDR is a nice solution. I don't find myself looking at a building and going, ooh, I could HDR that. I mean, to me, HDR is not a verb, it's a solution, but that's me. So
I think it's perfectly legitimate to have that. I didn't mean to interrupt, but
sure,
my
overall feeling is I see some HDR work that I think is tremendous, and I see others where I wish there was an ability in all the HDR software, whichever one you're using, where you move that one slider, and when you let go, it kind of goes back about 20%. Because I think most people just go about 20% too much into the hyper-realism look because, you know, I mean, I'm not going to contradict myself a little bit because I'm like, hey, do whatever you want. But, I mean, when I'm talking about my personal taste, would I put something on my wall? Yes, if it was HDR that I didn't look at and go, I know they use HDR on that because the sky looks like unrealistic and stormy and the buildings are neon-y glowing and for certain things, I think that
there's halos
good,
everywhere.
But it's not my personal taste. But at the same time, I'm like, hey, if you want to do it, go for it.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. I really think that people could come down pretty much anywhere on the spectrum as far as what's quote unquote acceptable. Because like you said, you know, it's all subjective. You know, there's no any one person that can say, well, that's wrong versus that's right.
I just
versus
know
that's
if you want
wrong.
To like generate huge traffic to your blog, just do a blog post that has the word HDR and do one either say HDR sucks or say HDR is amazing. And you'll get all this traffic with people comment. And if you throw in like RAW versus JPEG, you'll have like a huge traffic.
Yeah, I think the big ones are HDR versus realism, RAW versus JPEG, Canon versus Nikon's another big one still. For some reason, no one gets that it's not the gear, it's the person.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever about that. And then the other one, I think, is Coke versus Pepsi, right? So those are the big, you know, hot topic buttons. Oh, and I'm sorry, the political one, the Republican versus Democrat or conservative versus
liberal.
Well,
I know I follow the wedding photography industry a lot, and their big thing is – sort of this controversial issue of people who've only been shooting weddings for 3 or 4 years are now teaching workshops on how to do weddings. And that's sort of a feeling amongst some people that doesn't seem right somehow that these so quote unquote rock star photographers are teaching workshops with like 60 weddings under their belt. But that's a whole nother story.
Well, you kind of intrigued me a little bit there. And I guess my answer to that question is some people actually do just get it that quickly. I'm trying to think of the gal's name. Oh, I forget her name off the top of my head. Some woman rocketed up to the top of
– I'm guessing Jasmine Starr is probably
– Jasmine Starr, thank you. You know, she just rocketed. Came out of nowhere, and now she's teaching these workshops.
Yeah.
But if you watch her seminars or her workshops, whatever you want to call them, or you go to one of her sessions – she really does know what she's talking about. She's got an incredible vision.
The difference with Jasmine, because I know Jasmine personally, and she'd be the first one to tell you that she's not the best photographer in the world, but what she is amazing at is marketing and branding herself. So people know her name as much because of the way she writes her blog than for the picture she takes.
Sure, and that kind of ties into the whole aspect of it of the business side of running photography business. Mm-hmm. You know, 90% of it is business, 10% of it is photography, which still some people don't seem to grasp. But and then you take other people like Joey L, for example, who are just again same thing right out of the gate. They just get it.
Yep.
You know, it happens almost intuitively for them, where other people like myself, it took me 3 years or whatever it was to figure out the difference between an f-stop and an aperture, the f-stop and a shutter speed.
Yep.
You know, it's just different people learn different things in different ways, and there's absolutely no problem with someone coming out and teaching it if they're capable of teaching it.
Yep.
You know, it's just from this end of the spectrum here. And the age-old joke, you know, that I've always heard in the education system is those that can't teach, and those that can't teach, teach phys ed, ha-ha kind of thing.
Which is but, ironic because my degree's in phys ed. But anyway.
Well, I didn't mean that.
We used to joke about two, when we were in the phys ed program, but I think the whole Jasmine Starr thing is there's a lot of grumpy old men in the wedding business that retire.
The same holds true in many venues, not just the wedding business. I'd say that holds true in the IT industry. I talk to engineers all the time that haven't been outside from behind a desk in centuries or whatever it is. And the PBX system is the same way, where it's like, really? You're still running on POTS? What happened to voice over IP? But anyway, that's like you said, that's a topic for another point in time. So you mentioned the website, DaveCrossWorkshops.com. Where else can people find you? I know you're on Twitter. What's your
Twitter
handle?
Is at Dave Cross.
At Dave Cross. Facebook
is? I also have a blog that I kind of separately from the Dave Cross Workshops. It's just dcross.com, where I post the occasional things. And if people are into Facebook, it's PS Guy Dave Cross is my Facebook page where I – post photo shoots and other stuff.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I said I was going to let you go 15 minutes
That's
ago.
Okay. Just
kept on talking and talking. I tend to get verbose at times.
When there's topics like Jasmine Starr, you can't cover that in 30 seconds.
Exactly. You can't help but be a little verbose. Well, again, thank you for coming on the show,
Dave. My pleasure.
We appreciate having you, and we'll get some links over in the show notes. This should be going up fairly shortly here because I'll be out of town for the next couple of days myself. So thank you again for coming on. We'll have the show notes up, and we'll see you next time here at the Learning Digital Photography Podcast.